I'd like now to welcome Mandivamba Rukuni. He is the author of the book, Being African, Rediscovering the Traditional Unhu Ubuntu Boto Pathways of Being Human. And he is also the Regional Director for African Programs with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation in Pretoria. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary.
It's wonderful to have you here, and it's a very interesting book. First of all, let's start with the words in the title that probably most of our listeners don't know. Unhu Ubuntu Poto, pathways. What do those words mean?
Unhu meaning actually being human, because the African idea of the difference between other animals and us is that we have a higher level of consciousness. So Unhu is really a human being, or being human. And that's Ubuntu.
So the book is really a call to African people, African American people, to follow a spiritual path, which is also very much of a practical path that's based in African tradition, African spirituality. Right. What led you, yourself, Western educated Christian, to start following this path and writing about it?
Well, because I'd been exposed to it as a young person to start with, before I started going to school, and then learning to speak English and learning about all the worldly knowledge in English. But as I got older and I became a professional, I began to realize that what human society is about, we probably have forgotten, and it's probably still somewhere forgotten back in the traditional values that I experienced as a young person in my family and community.
So that's saying quite a lot, that the world has forgotten what human society is all about.
I think we are lost.
In what way are we lost, and what do you think human society is about that we need to refind?
I mean, I just have to start with the most advanced society in the whole world, the United States of America.
Advanced in some ways.
In some ways, but you can look at how technologically advanced we have become over the last 100 years. You would think that with all this technology, which spans from biological technologies, are able to cure diseases, grow crops, to physical ones, you know, we're able to fly fast around the world, even send people to the moon. But we have no clue how to construct a violent-free society. We have lost capacity to actually craft viable, sustainable families where young people grow up in safe, loving, respectful environment. So in spite of all these advances, we've forgotten what is truly the human values.
Now, did you grow up in a safe, loving, functional society and family?
Absolutely. In fact, I was telling a group of young American youngsters in May this year when I visited, and they were, to me, they looked pretty much like very angry, disinterested youngsters in life. They're just disappointed, and I was saying to them, you know, look at me. I'm from Africa. I grew up with no shoes until I was about 11. And no electricity, no radio, no television to entertain me, no refrigerator to pull out juice. And I said to them, and we even had real witches in our village, you know, not imaginary ones you see on television. So raise up your hand if you feel sorry for me. And they all raised up their hand. And I said to them, I'm really sorry to disappoint you, because even in my material poverty as a youngster, I was infinitely happier than I see you today. Because I grew up, I was brought up in a loving, caring, respectful family. I grew up knowing who I was and happy with who I was. I did not want to be anybody else. I didn't want to be the son of the rich man next door. So I'm capable of being happy, irrespective of my material well-being. This is what the world has lost. And that's why we've drifted into individualism, consumerism, greed, and violence, drugs. And I don't believe that we even know now how to stop the environmental degradation, the high level of consumption of limited and resources that we have, which will plunge us in less than 100 years backwards as in terms of civilization.
So you, I mean, in a way, you don't know how to stop it. Nobody knows how to stop it. We all feel like we're heading for the edge of a cliff. But on the other hand, you've written this book, which is really a call for a renaissance of life practices and values.
I have, because I still see, well, when I look at Africa, 70% of our people are still rural. Okay, they are poor. But the idea of a big city or the big city-state is failing in Africa. In fact, it has failed. You just have to go to any of the big cities, Johannesburg, Harare, Lagos. It's total chaos. So in many ways, we are lucky that this model has failed in Africa. Because if it had succeeded, then it would be a lot more difficult to reverse this trend of creating huge urban industrial complexes, which really are breeding ground for morons, where you have 90% plus of your populations living in, and that society becomes more difficult to redress. But I think in Africa, we have a lot of scope for redressing this, and a lot of scope for having a society which is less destructive of the environment, less violent, and more capable of having smaller communities that are self-sustaining and not reliant too much on heavy-duty state-sponsored infrastructure.
One of the things that is a problem on the whole planet, whether it be the United States or various countries in Africa or Europe or wherever, is the question of the relationship between population numbers and the ability of the land to sustain us. So we've overfished the seas, and yes, we have really over-cultivated the land and cultivated it badly. How do you take that into account? I know this is one of your areas of expertise, when you talk about going to from an urban to a more village-based system.
Well, if we just start with the most limiting factor in terms of the rate at which we sustain the 6-7 billion people on the planet, it's fossil fuels. I mean, and the reserves in the ground today are not going to last more than another 30 to 50 years. So it doesn't matter how we look at it. In 50 years' time, we won't have the oil, the coal, and the natural grass to sustain 6 billion, or at that time it would be 10 billion people. So when these natural resources run out, the energy reserves that remain on Earth in terms of trees and so on that we can harvest immediately can only sustain maybe less than 1 billion people. So what's going to happen to the 5-10 billion? So already we are on a path where we have to reduce the extent to which we have an agricultural system so dependent on fossil fuels to cultivate as well as to fertilize the land. It's just not sustainable. We have to go back to find other ways of producing sufficient food locally that is consumed locally, rather than the United States producing most of the food to feed the developing world thousands of miles away, which is the current situation.
When you look actually at, I mean, Africa is a vast continent, and when you look at the arable land there and the numbers of people there, let's say there were no fossil fuels, everybody was cultivating the land by hand and fertilizing with natural materials and dung and plowed by oxen and all of that stuff, do you have the ability to feed an increasing population in Africa, self-sustaining?
Well, you see, the issue we're faced with is that the population in Africa at the moment will not be sustained by an organic farming within the next few years. We are already too many. But we are too many because the population growth was spared by this availability of fossil fuels worldwide.
Right.
So although going back is not the solution, the point is continuing on the path that we have now, which will end up with 10, 12 billion people on this planet in another 30 to 50 years, is worse. So we need a middle ground where we start reversing this, whilst finding alternative ways of using energy more sustainably. And unfortunately, we just have to have fewer people on this planet.
We're talking to Mandivamba Rukuni, whose book is called Being African. And he will be speaking at Garcia Street Books, by the way, tomorrow, Friday, August 29th at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You mentioned in the book the relationship between African culture and Western culture, and you say, let's modernize but not westernize. And you talk about ways in which other cultures, Asian and European and so on, have modernized. But what's the distinction between modernizing and westernizing?
Well, the distinction is, if you know, ancient cultural wisdom is the wisdom that has existed over long periods of time. But over time, some of that gets outdated, or a situation changes so that it becomes less relevant. Modernizing means you adapt your culture to meet the contemporary situation. An example is the shirt I'm putting on now. This is an African shirt. Okay, you cannot mistake it for a Western shirt.
Right.
But this is not what my ancestors used to put on, is it? No. I have modernized an African way of looking at dress. This is modernization, not Westernization.
Interesting.
So, same thing, you could come and look at my home in Africa. You find that it's pretty comfortable home. But the architecture is not Western. It's an African architecture. That's modernization. Westernization means wholesale, you believe that you stop being African. You learn a foreign language, you speak their language, you take their religion, you take their educational system, you take their monetary system, you just take wholesale everything they have. The problem with that, of course, is that you can never be an American. You can never perfect that culture because you don't know where it started and where it's going.
So you as an African can never be an American. Yeah.
No, I can never beat an American at being an American.
Right.
And the Americans can never beat me at being an African. So I'm better off improving what I have and then borrowing intelligently. I can borrow from American culture, but incorporate it in my culture, Africanize it.
You talk about reviving African culture and languages and how important it is to have people speak and know their languages. There's so many languages. So how do you work the dialectic between, on the one hand, having unity, and on the other hand, speaking many disparate languages?
Well, it's simple. I mean, it should be simple. We've made it complicated. The thing is, it is possible to use a mother tongue for education, for educating.
What's your mother tongue?
My mother tongue is Shona, which is one of maybe five languages in my country. But mine is spoken by about 80%, because it's a small country, so it's possible.
Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe. So it's possible to have a majority of people speak one language. But the point is that educating people in mother tongue makes it easier for people to relate education to their day-to-day lives.
Now, were you educated in your native language?
I was educated in English.
In English.
And that's why I explain in this book that in spite of my high level of education, I still have not been able to be effective in transforming the lives of the majority of people in my own extended family or tribe.
You don't speak fluent Shona?
I speak fluent Shona, but knowledge is not transferable like that. This is the whole point.
Right.
Knowledge is not, because knowledge is bound by culture. Translating it back into a cultural setting requires interpretation and reinterpretation of the same knowledge you think you have. That's why we have the third world today, where you'd think that with the amount of language and technology available in the world, you wouldn't have such poor countries, would you? But why aren't they changing in spite of all this available English language and available technology? It's because they don't easily translate when you get to the village level. What you think is knowledge that's applicable, you'll find that within that cultural setting is not acceptable, it doesn't quite fit. So you're better off educating people in their own mother language, so that they can immediately interpret the cultural meaning. I mean, take this little book I wrote on being African. I failed to write this book in English. It took me 10 years to write this book in English. And I didn't know that was the reason why I couldn't write it. Then 3 years ago, I taught a whole course for 10 days. I took 45 youth into the mountains in the boot camp about being African and taught it in my mother tongue. Within a month of doing that, I was able to rewrite the whole book in my head and then translated it back to English.
And then translated
it. Because cultural knowledge is bound in language. Just an hour ago, I was talking to some Native Americans at a school,
the Indian school?
Yeah, Santa Fe Indian school. And I find similarities, very striking similarities. Those Native Americans who stopped speaking their native language and use English as a mother tongue are able to educate their kids in English, and there's no, what is lost in their culture is lost. So they become American. The only problem is down the road they wish that their kids would speak the language and reinvent the language. So it's a different problem to where in some of the pueblos the kids are brought up in their traditional language. And then when they go to school they have to learn English. And then there is a clash. Because then what's more important? I was given an example of, say, a child who would be required to attend a traditional ceremony or ritual at home, but at school they are required to attend class. And if they want to have a 100% attendance record, where do you go? Which is more important? Okay, so these conflicts are everywhere, but I find nations who have transcended them better than others are ones who take knowledge from English-speaking world and translate it into their own language,
right,
like the Japanese did and the Chinese. Teach their kids in English and in university in their own language, and then learn English as a foreign language.
Now, when you talk about being African, Africa is a very big place with many different cultures and, one could argue, many different cultural values. Are you saying that there is something that is transcendently African that unifies everybody on the continent?
In fact, I can go as far as saying that in spite of gazillion differences between different tribes of the whole world, I could pretty well write a book about the few values that are held by all human beings. So the same applies to Africa. In spite of the vast differences in culture and language, there are elements, and I put 10 of them in this little book.
Right, and which are very human elements, like laugh, play, and have fun, talk and listen with others,
yes,
give generously, receive with gratitude, and so on. Those are not just African, obviously. They're transcendent.
They're transcendent. So to be truly African is to be a true human being.
What does it mean, though, to be truly African in distinction to other cultures? What does it mean to be specifically African?
Well, I find that it's the way that our ancestors weaved into the cultural vessel elements of language and religion and education. Because you find that within the broader cultural setting, one of the most important things is believing in your ancestors, following the footsteps of your forebearers. Strong belief, not only that they're your connection to God, but also that they held wisdom tested over years available to you free of charge, that you had to rely on before you were too clever to start new ideas. I find that cutting across almost all of Africa. Then that same belief of value transcends then into understanding of oneness. Oneness between family members, oneness between relatives, and probably just as important, relationship between people and the environment. The environment is always bigger than people. We are part of the environment. We are not superior to the environment. That's a strong value I find in African culture, which I don't find in American culture, for instance, or European culture, where I see a lot of belief that science and knowledge makes people above the environment. You can destroy the environment and reconstruct it, or you can do whatever. When in traditional African beliefs, you are below. You are just part of it. So you are connected to the trees, the animals. You are connected to them just in as much as you're connected to God and your relatives. So you're
and many of the myths and stories that you talk about in the book reflect that.
Reflect, yeah. So I'm just telling you two of the important values which mean a lot in terms of how that translates to practical realities in life. Because as a youngster believing in that, it was almost impossible for me to go and chop down trees randomly.
Right.
It was not possible. The belief was, you don't do that. You're killing yourself, you're killing your ancestors, and you're killing God. Now, with the knowledge that I have about science and what I can do and regenerate and GMOs, blah, blah, well, does it matter if I chop down half the forest? No, we'll find a way of reforesting or some other solution. So the value system has gone out of the window, and I've adopted a completely different value system.
One of the things that you also talk about as being very important is the African family structure, which is family, extended family, and so on, and how important it is to recognize that your father's brother is also your father and your mother's sister is also your mother. And I wonder, you know, what will happen and how do you think about this in a world where population really has to reduce if we're going to sustain ourselves and people won't have so many brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and cousins if we are going to voluntarily reduce our population?
Well, if you go back to the time when the extended family was of real value, it was less than a billion people on the planet. So actually it's not so much an aggregate number game. It's much more to do with how if you want unity and reliance on each other is perceived within a cultural setting, and
whether it be actual blood family or otherwise.
Oh yes, absolutely. And as you will not, as you will notice, I cover in the book. Once you have friends, neighbors in the community, ultimately the bonds can be just as strong as relatives, and they may play a different role in your life. But the oneness between humans and humans and the environment is not present within African culture.
Now, this is a book, obviously, not just for Africans, African Americans, the African diaspora, but really for everybody. Here you are in Santa Fe, which is about the most un-African city you can find.
You can say that again.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, although I wrote the book for Africans, and the reason I insisted, and I still insist, is primarily for Africans, is because it is important for Africans to believe again that their self-identity and their culture will not only hold some wisdom for us recreating a dynamic society, but also if Africa is going to fulfill its destiny of also contributing to the world, whatever value, wisdom we have, this is it. So in that sense, this little message that I have is a message to the world, and that maybe it's time that the rest of the world, which may be advanced over Africa in many other respects, particularly wealth and material, but if we're going to look at this world 30 to 50 years from now, it may just be that Africa does have an important answer to the puzzle of what happens when we have overrun all the resources we have in the world.
Mandivamba Rukuni is the author of the book Being African, Rediscovering the Traditional Unu Ubuntu Boto Pathways of Being Human. He is the regional director for African programs with the W.K. Kellogg Foundation in Pretoria, and he will be at Garcia Street Books tomorrow, Friday, the 29th of August, at 5 in the afternoon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Al Cohn. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Hasta la vista. Ciao.